welcome to 2819. I'm Sandra Dimas.
And I'm Brian Rohenbacher.
And this week we have kind of a buffet for your mind. Lots of variety of topics today.
That's right. Can't wait to get into it. In RTB 101, Crystal will be interviewing biochemist Fuzzle Rana on if we evolved from an ancient common ancestor.
And in Give and Take, Jeff Zwerink will talk with petroleum engineer Pat McGuire on CO2 and if it will destroy the Earth. Might want to know that.
First up is Culture Talk. Sandra will be chatting with Jeff Zwerink about how this tiny little particle that we can't even see could expand our understanding of the universe. Let's check it out.
Now it's time for Culture Talk, where we talk about culturally relevant topics that you can use to start conversations about your faith. And I'm joined today with astrophysicist Jeff Zwerink. Thank you for joining us.
Sandra, thanks for the invitation.
We're going to be talking about teeny tiny particles.
You betcha.
Yeah, you know, I saw this article in Apple News, and I was really intrigued by it. And so, of course, I sent it off to you right away and wanted to know, hey, can we talk about it? And it is it featured a video with Neil deGrasse Tyson where he explains that a tiny particle could expand our understanding of the natural world. So what is this discovery?
Well, okay, so the discovery, it's actually been a redoing of an experiment that was done about 20 years ago. And the mundane explanation is we're measuring this particular quantity and we can calculate this particular quantity out to 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 places of the decimal, and they don't agree. What we expect from our calculations and what we measure in the lab don't line up. And so why that's a big deal is that we have this thing called the standard model in particle physics. It's got electrons and protons and quarks and gluons, and it explains all of the fundamental interactions that we see, gravity, electromagnetism, strong and weak nuclear force. All that's included in there. It's all the particles that we see, and it explains almost all the data that we have out there.
Right.
And so we've got a calculation from that model that doesn't line up with what we measure. And so that's the exciting part, because if that's a genuine discrepancy, it says there's some new physics out there that we don't know about. And so it's a way to say, hey, let's go look for this new physics. That's what's really exciting about it.
That's a lot to unpack. So first, let's go to one thing that you said is if that calculation is correct. So is there agreement yet, or is there further study on that calculation?
Well, they're very complex calculations, and so a lot of people have done them. I mean, there's been a lot of people who worked at that, but that's the way science often works, is that you say, okay, you make these calculations, and they predict this, and so obviously there was some level of confidence in the calculation in the first place. You go out, you make the measurement, and you get that, and then when they disagree, you got to figure out, is that a experiment error, is that a calculation error, or is it a genuine discrepancy? And so there's pretty good confidence in the calculation, but it may not be correct. Again, there's a lot that goes into this, and we could be missing something. So.
Yeah, so now assuming though that the calculation is correct, so let's move from there then. If it's correct, then we have kind of like this new kid in town, right, who comes in and shakes things up. What does that mean when you said that we might have a new like physics?
Well, okay, so in the standard model, there are some number of particles. There's quarks, there's gluons, there's things that govern the forces, there's particles that get acted on by these forces, and we've got a complete, in the standard model, there's a complete inventory of those. Well, if we make all the calculations based on the standard model, that's the discrepancy with the measurement. That means that there's probably another particle out there that we don't know of, which is a really exciting thing. So now, how do we go figure out what that particle is? What does it look like? What are its characteristics? So it's you know, if you could liken it, you know, we've been searching for dark matter. We know it's out there. We've measured the gravitational effects of it for the last 80 years. We think there's a particle that does that, but we don't know what the particle is. So there's been a lot of effort trying to figure out what the particle is. That's kind of what would happen here. There's another particle out there. Let's go figure out what it is.
What is the name of the particle, by the way?
Well, the one that they're doing the experiment on is called a muon. So you're familiar with electrons, or that's the one that's more common. An electron has two heavier cousins. One's a muon, and one is a called a tauon. And so when you're doing the muon, it has this thing that acts like spin. It's not actually spin. And so when you run it around in a magnetic field, it behaves a certain way, and that's the discrepancy in the measurement. What we expect, or what we measured it does with this spin, and what we calculate it does with this spin, doesn't line up.
So then from a Christian perspective, is this like point one for the Christians? Or like, I mean, not that we're like wanting to do verses, but you know, when we get new information, we think, okay, how does this easily align with the Christian faith? Does it seem to challenge it? So how would you view that?
Well, the way I would view it is this, mm-hmm. is that, you know, as a Christian, I believe that God's revealed himself in Scripture, mm-hmm. and that as we study that revelation, we are going to better understand it over time, but we will never plumb the depths of all that it has to say. Mm-hmm. God has also revealed himself in creation, physical world. So as we understand the universe, we're going to understand more and more of how it works, but we're never going to plumb the depths mm-hmm. of what that is. This to me is a sign that says, okay, we've got a pretty good understanding and now there's more to explore. And so it helps us probe deeper and get deeper into that mm-hmm. stuff that's there. And my expectation is once we figure out, let's assume this is a real discrepancy and we figure out what the cause and everything, that's going to open up new problems that we didn't even know to explore. Right. So it just gives us an opportunity to explore deeper and deeper and deeper and understand. And if God is who he says he is, we're never going to exhaust what there is to understand. And that's exciting.
Yeah. Oh, I love your energy. I love that you're like super excited. Because that's great, because then it encourages exploration mm-hmm. with confidence and with ease, you know?
Absolutely.
To not be scared.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that was a groundbreaking recognition for mm-hmm. me, believe it or not, was the recognition that if God is who he says he is, how he's revealed himself right. in Scripture and how he's revealed himself in creation, we'll never disagree. And where I find disagreement, it just means I've done something wrong and I need to explore deeper. Well, right. kind of what's going on here. We've said we thought we understood the theory and it says this. We made a measurement and it says this. We don't just throw our hands up and say, oh, well, science is just right. bad. Oh, no, this is a sign into something deeper. Right. Let's explore that and figure out what yeah. it's telling us.
And it's kind of amazing to think that there might be, even like today, as we know that the scientific discovery has been going on for centuries, mm-hmm. that there's still more to explore about our Earth and mm-hmm. also our universe and beyond. That's pretty amazing.
Absolutely. I mean, we think we know a lot. We right. actually do know a lot. Right. I don't want to minimize that.
Right.
But there's a whole lot that we just kind of know on the surface we don't really understand, right. even though we can put the math behind it. So I think this is what we're going to be doing in heaven for eternity, is just exploring God, understanding who he is, exploring his creation, and we're going to do it without getting tired or frustrated, and we're just going to keep learning and growing, and that's going to be fascinating.
Yeah. Well, where can people go to find more information?
If you want to go find out about the experiment itself, it's the Muon G2 experiment.
So just look, M-U-O-N.
M-U-O-N G-2. You'll get links to Fermilab, which did the experiment yeah. recently. Also, just go to reasons.org, figure out how science and the Christian faith work together. Not anything specific about that experiment, but how to look at scientific discoveries in general.
Well, thank you so much for that, Jeff. And if you want to hear more from Jeff, go to reasons.org and search for his blog, Impact Events.
Now it's time for RTB 101, where we discuss practical questions to equip you to share your faith more effectively. And here to help me talk about a very provocative question, did we evolve from an ancient common ancestor, is my colleague, Dr. Fuzz Rana. Welcome, Fuzz.
Krista, thanks for having me.
It's always great to have you here. And this is a very common question that comes up whenever we're talking about evolution. And I think every once in a while, we sort of hear in the news, you know, that scientists have discovered the last universal common ancestor. But I'm not really sure I 100% know what that term even means. So maybe we should start with some kind of definition.
Yeah, well, the last universal common ancestor, sometimes it's called LUCA for short, is believed to be, by evolutionary biologists, the organism or maybe a community of organisms that essentially anchor the evolutionary tree of life. And the view is that all life eventually emerges from this cell that, again, anchors the evolutionary tree of life, and that this last universal common ancestor eventually gave rise to the two major branches on the tree of life, bacteria and archaea. And then from archaea, there's another branch that gave rise to what's known as the eukaryotic organisms.
So I think that gives us a good place to start. So if I think about evolution as a tree, this is kind of something that is down near the roots of the tree that helps kind of be at that foundation, from what I understand, of everything comes from that. And you said it was a cell. Maybe you could tell me a little bit more about what kind of life form this is.
Yeah, and you know, you're right. The way to think about it is that this is, again, the organism or maybe a community of organisms that kind of root the evolutionary tree. And many people believe that LUCA actually is the end product of the origin of life process, where you have molecules on the early Earth presumably organizing into the very first cell-like entities that then would evolve to give rise to this, again, this organism called LUCA. And so LUCA would be, again, a simple type of cell, but that the more that we are learning about what would be the requirements for LUCA from an evolutionary perspective, the more troubling it really becomes, in my opinion, for the evolutionary paradigm, because we're learning that LUCA must have been an incredibly complex organism that would have had the totality of the core biochemical systems that we see in all life on Earth in place. And so the more we learn about what the requirements would be for LUCA, the more complex this organism becomes.
That's really important. I think what I hear you saying in that is that this complexity in this was supposed to be the last universal common ancestor for life happens early. And so does that then, just to extend that thought, is that a problem for the evolutionary framework, that it doesn't appear like it's, these things have gradually evolved, rather it needs to have full functioning complexity almost from the beginning?
Yes, because the complexity is what our friend Michael Behe would call irreducible complexity. That is, not only does it look like the core biochemical systems are in place in LUCA, they have to be present. If they're not present, then LUCA simply would not be capable of functioning as a bona fide life form. And when we look at the natural history of life on Earth, we see that life appears very early in Earth's history. As soon as the Earth can support life, life appears on the planet. There's a very, very narrow window of time for the origin of life to take place. And the geochemical and fossil record indicate that these first life forms, even though they were simple cells, biochemically speaking, they were incredibly complex organisms. And so then we see also that the demands on LUCA suggest that this was a complex organism where the biochemical systems that were present in it are irreducibly complex. So when you see that convergence of those different lines of evidence, it really seems to indicate that that LUCA must have been created, that it could not have been the product of an evolutionary history. There's just not enough time to produce that kind of complexity even in a simple cell.
Well, I'm glad you led us to that kind of landing place there, because let's flip the script a little bit for the second half of the segment. And from your perspective, as someone who is an old Earth creationist, you know, lead us through a little bit of an understanding of what you think the first life was like from a creation model perspective.
Yeah, well, you know, from my perspective, again, the very first life on Earth would have been the product of a creator's handiwork, and that I would take the view that it would have, that this life form would be intrinsically complex and would also display the features of a well-designed system. And you know, interestingly enough, the argument that evolutionary biologists make for the existence of LUCA is the fact that every organism on the planet has the same type of biochemistry. So the argument would be that this shared biochemistry is evidence that life must have come from a single cell that would have already had that biochemistry in place. But my view would be that the universal nature of biochemistry reflects shared design, not shared ancestry, and that the biochemical systems that make up life are highly elegant, sophisticated, fine-tuned systems that reflect the design and the handiwork of a creator.
So from there then, from that kind of complex organism, even though it's a single-celled organism, it may look simple to me as a layperson, but if we were to look deeper, we would see truly how ornate that is. But then I think it's also important to clarify from that life form, we would say that God then intervenes periodically to create new life. We don't believe that life just evolved from that original cellular organism.
Yeah, that's a really good point of clarification, Krista, is that our view is that not only did God intervene to bring about the creation of the very first cell, but that throughout life's history, God is intervening repeatedly to bring about his creative purposes, and that there's clear evidence for that intervention throughout life's history, not only again at the origin of life, but at other key transitions in life's history as well. And that we would take the view too, that when we examine not only the appearance of these organisms, but the details of their design, we would see clear evidence for a creator's fingerprints.
Well, thank you, Fuzz, for helping us think through this very fascinating topic. I want to refer people to Fuzz's blog, The Cell's Design. You can find it by going to reasons.org.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink here, and welcome to Give and Take, the segment of our show where we talk about neat and interesting scientific ideas and see how they interact with the truth of Christianity. Today, we're joined by Pat McGuire, and we're going to explore the consequences of rising carbon dioxide on the Earth. Pat, it's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Jeff.
So just kind of by way of reminder, I know you've got a background in mechanical engineering, a master's there. You've done a lot of work in petroleum engineering. How do you extract oil from deep in the earth? And along with that, you get to study the consequences. One of the consequences of extracting oil is that we've put some carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And so kind of start the question, is the amount of carbon dioxide rising on the earth, and is humanity contributing to that?
Yes, indeed. I'm actually on the Carbon Advisory Council for the Society of Petroleum Engineers. And since burning oil and gas causes a lot of carbon dioxide emissions, this is very near and dear to the Society of Petroleum Engineers.
So it's clearly increasing, and obviously humans have a contribution to what's going on there. I guess, so rather than worry about whether we're quibbling over whether that's going on, that seems pretty well solid and established, if you will. I guess the bigger question I have is, how big a deal is the rising carbon dioxide levels on the Earth?
Well, that really is the big question. There's no doubt that it's going up. We've got the measurements in Mauna Kea, the big volcano in Hawaii, and also in the heart of Antarctica. So we know globally the CO2 is going up. And the real issue is that good or bad?
Yeah. We've got a lot of indication that it's causing the temperatures to increase. So initially it seems like that's a bad idea because we're changing things from the way they are, the way nature would have them, if you will.
Okay. And the best answer for that, I think, is to look at the geological context of what CO2 has done through the Earth's history. Mm-hmm. And there's a particular graph I really like. It shows the CO2 concentrations for the last 600 million years in the atmosphere. And one of the things you observe immediately from looking at that data is that we are in a very low point historically, geologically, for concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere.
So over the last 600 million years, historically, carbon dioxide levels have been much higher, and presumably they've been dropping. Is it just kind of a steady drop, or has it been more sporadic?
Well, it's interesting because it's been kind of a overall a steady decline from maybe 3,000 or 4,000 parts per million CO2 down now, we're at about 400.
Okay.
But fact is, we're lower in CO2 right now than it has ever been in the history of planet Earth, except for the Carboniferous period, which is about 300 something million years ago.
Okay.
And that's the point in time at which all the coal deposits were laid down. The geologic age was actually called the Pennsylvanian, after all the Pennsylvania coal deposits.
Ah, okay.
But the CO2 took this huge dive.
Presumably because it was all being sequestered in the coal.
Because it was all being sequestered into these gigantic layers of coal.
Okay.
And nowadays, when a tree falls in a swamp, there's a lot of critters, bacteria, that would like to eat that tree and recycle it.
Okay.
But one of the leading theories is back in the 300-something million years ago, the bacteria had not yet evolved the enzymes necessary to attack cellulose so it didn't decay.
So that's why you end up with these large cultures.
And then all of a sudden, the CO2 spikes upwards.
Okay.
And so it looks like life kind of took care of the coal deposits after a while, and now we're back on this high level of CO2 that's continued to decline.
So what happens if the carbon dioxide gets too low? What are the consequences of that? I mean, it seemed like you extract it, things get cooler, keeps things from getting hot at least, and that's a good thing.
Well, interestingly enough, you can extract so much CO2 from the atmosphere that you get yourself in serious trouble. And in about 15,000 BC, and people were round during this time frame,
right,
we came this close to the greatest mass extinction event on planet Earth. The carbon dioxide levels got down to 180 parts per million. So
a little less than half of what they are today.
And that's the lowest CO2 ever recorded in the 4 billion year history of planet Earth.
Okay.
The reason that's important is because at 150 parts per million, most plant life on land dies. So we were 30 parts per million from extinction of most of the plant life on land, at least.
So all the plant life dies, a whole lot of other things die because of that, correct?
So
this is major mass extinction type thing that we're talking about.
Big deal. If that happened, then you lose essentially all of the plant life that we eat and essentially all of the plant life that most animal life eats. So this would have been a real, this would have been a bad time on planet Earth. We got that close.
So that kind of puts the rising carbon dioxide, it seems to me to have a flip side of that effect is that while yes, the temperatures may go up, increasing carbon dioxide presumably would contribute to more food production or more plant production, which is food production for a lot of
yes.
the Earth.
And, actually, that's a huge issue. This temperature increases is one issue, but another huge issue is feeding 8 billion human beings on planet Earth. And crop yields, they go up dramatically as the CO2 level increases. And actually, human agriculture was not possible until we hit about 250 parts per million. So when you look at it, agriculture emerged in South America, China, Middle East, Europe, all around the world when the atmospheric conditions reached 250 parts per million. And now we're at a little over 400 parts per million, and the crop yields are up maybe 30% from what they would have been then.
So an increasing carbon dioxide level, so you've got this kind of two competing effects. The temperature is going to go up, but our capacity to produce food is going to go up. And people need food, so that there's this good part and this bad part. So how do we wrestle with that?
Well, it's an optimization problem, and engineers are trained to optimize things. And my favorite example of optimization is a laptop computer.
Right.
Now, I'd love a 36-inch screen on my laptop. That would be great, but it won't fit in my backpack.
Right.
But if I make it really small, my eyes aren't what they used to be. I can't read a small screen, and I can't type on a small keyboard.
But the battery will last for a long time.
And if I want to have the battery last on my 15 or 20-inch laptop, if I make it where it'll last a week, it's so heavy I can't carry it. So
right. So
you have to optimize all these things to get to a global optimum. And that's, I think, the approach we need to take for carbon dioxide emissions is at what level does the temperature increase become serious, and how in the world am I going to feed another billion people? So it definitely becomes an optimization problem.
You know, it's interesting. Your comments are related to kind of two things. One, we want to take care of the planet, but two, we also want to take care of people. You know, the Bible talks about how we're stewards of this creation so that it takes, so that we can take care of people as well. And so your comments here even just reinforce the way the Bible has described our role here on earth. And I just really appreciate your comments and thanks for joining us today. So, you know, when we look at global warming, we tend to get divided into political camps as to whether CO2 and increased temperatures are good or bad. And I like what Pat's comments were about how to look at this from an optimization problem. And how do we be good stewards of this creation that God has given us? We obviously want to take care of people, and so rising crops help us do that well. But we also want to take care of the planet, and so how do we do that well? You know, I would encourage you to go to reasons.org. We have a page where we talk about global warming, where we separate some of the political issues, and we really get into the theological and the scientific issues. So if you go to reasons.org, search on global warming, you will get some resources that help you understand how to navigate that and to be able to bring the gospel into your conversations about global warming.
That does it for us this week on 2819. We hope you enjoyed this episode and that this little bit of a buffet of different topics really filled up your mind. We also hope that you now feel equipped to share your faith with confidence and compassion.
And if you're hungry for more, subscribe to the show and also search for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are at 2819 Show. We'd love to hear from you.
And if you like the audio version of our show, you can get it on most major podcast services. Just search Reasons to Believe Podcast.
See you next week.
Bye.